With all that music, I feel this might be an anticlimax. I have to confess, I had a little trouble trying to think of what to say because in the lectionary, the title was Waiting in Fear, and I had some trouble dealing with that. So what I have to say is something that has often occupied my mind in the past, and so I'll dwell on that, and it is somewhat related to the theme of waiting in fear. The question is, what do we do while we're waiting? Presumably, the notion of waiting is to wait for the coming of Christ, and the question is, what do we do while we're waiting? If you do some reading in the Old Testament, there are two images that seem to emerge. One is that while you're waiting, you should be working, you should be laboring. And on the one hand, laboring and working has a kind of negative context. The notion that you shall work by the sweat of your brow as a sort of punishment. On the other hand, there's a theme of working in which work is a kind of creation. You create things for the betterment of the world. And I'd like to focus today on the issue of work and labor while we're waiting. In the readings in the Old Testament, it seems to me, and I'm not a theologian, so I stand corrected, but it seems to me that the readings in the Old Testament have to do with working and labor for the Hebrew nation, that it is directed towards an ultimate future where the nation shall emerge victorious and people will live within God's commandments. In the New Testament, it seems to me, the issue of labor and working, on the one hand, from the Old Testament, it can be a bit of a curse. On the other hand, it can be beneficial and it contributes to the world, but the rewards are not in this life. The rewards in the New Testament are in life after death, it seems to me, but I stand corrected. There are theologians in the crowd. And so I'd like to speak a little bit about the issue of labor and what it might mean in terms of the biblical sense. I want to kind of focus on the New Testament readings and what that might mean. Because the problem of extending rewards for labor in life after death leaves us with no way of knowing what comes as a result of our labor. We can only assume that by virtuous labor that somehow we will be rewarded in life after death. But having such a faith is difficult. The question remains for the devout Christians whether she or he is among the saved. The Catholic priest can relieve that burden, but not the Protestant. The resulting anxiety for the Protestant, it seems to me, is that the centerpiece of the belief is that if we become servants for God, we shall eventually have our reward in heaven, but still we are a little concerned about whether we are doing the right thing in order to achieve that reward. That's the kind of question that is raised by a sociologist. Here I'm more comfortable talking. By Max Weber in his thesis on the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. In Max Weber's notion, one of the reasons that the capitalist society emerged was because the Protestants had no way of knowing whether or not they are among the saved. And so, according to Weber, one looked in this world about whether or not one was favored by the labor that one did. If you grew wealthy, and you worked hard, and you grew wealthy, certainly that must be a sign that you must be among the saved in life after death. It's not for sure, but if God is consistent, one would think that working hard and getting wealthy seems to indicate that you're in good shape in life after death. And so from Weber's point of view, that kind of belief system really gave birth to the notion of capitalism. Weber argued that, in effect, what we call capitalism now is a secular form of the Protestant ethic. And Weber seemed to stress the idea that in that system, there never seems to be enough. That economic growth and development and their rewards were the means by which the early Protestant might assume that rewards in this life were surely signs of rewards in heaven. From this point of view, the constant emphasis on growth and accumulation is a means for the faithful servant who is driven by the need to feel secure in the afterlife, despite the biblical injunction against storing up riches here on earth. I once heard an evangelist, by the way, proclaim that God wants you to succeed and be wealthy. Again, it's supposed to be a sign that we are favored in life after death. Of course, the religious trappings, if Weber's thesis is true, the religious trappings of gaining wealth have largely dropped away, except for those rare occasions when that wealth is used for charitable purposes. Still, we continue to measure ourselves on how we stand relative to others on income and position. Our society is sort of built on this competitive notion. And as such, especially in the Western world, work and hard work is good in and of itself, and income is a sign of your worth. Needless to say, the religious trappings of gaining wealth have largely dropped away. And we need to remind ourselves about what this kind of emphasis and what this kind of drive might mean. We are now finding from research that is being done on income and happiness that happiness is related to income only up to a certain point, and then that relationship breaks away. So you don't get any happier at the upper levels of income. Indeed, security becomes more and more of a problem. So the question is, why this constant drive for wealth, for position, why this constant emphasis on competition? Incidentally, recent research has shown that the happiest people in the world appear to be living in Finland, where the living standards are high, but inequality is low, and working hours are fairly short, and leaves of absence are very generous, which is quite the opposite of what we experience here in the West. Our worth ethic does not seem to allow one to decide what is enough. Growth is a rallying cry in our society, and it is almost a matter of pride that one works long hours with a connotation of importance and hopes for financial success. And so it seems ironic that in Christmas time, the time when we celebrate Christ's birth and demonstrate our love to others through our gifts, it's also a time of heightened economic activity. The means have overshadowed the ends as we are overwhelmed by advertisements. I don't know if you get all the flyers in your mailbox that we've gotten with respect to Black Friday, and I'm sure that what's going to happen is Boxing Day after Christmas. The emphasis is constantly on now is the time to buy those gifts, and now is the time to enrich yourselves or enrich your close friends. It's the very time when gifts, not earned products, are supposed to characterize the spirit of Christmas. If this is the outcome of what Christmas means, we have lost, it seems to me, the notion of gifts. Gifts are not something that you purchase or that have a financial value on it. Gifts are something that you give out of generosity of the spirit. And what we now have, it seems to me, is a season where we give purchased goods. I don't know about you, but in our family, each of us are asked to draw up lists of what we want for Christmas. It's not a big surprise when the box comes, but it becomes a time where you kind of hold off of what you'd really want when Christmas comes along while you indicate that to the rest of the family. And sure enough, there it is. And we don't even try to hide it. Like when I was a child, what we used to do is buy a small gift, put it in a larger box, and that box in a larger box, and that in a larger box. So you'd really fool the person who is getting that kind of gift. There's a second theme that we seem to forget in Christmas, and that is the idea that we are to take periodic leave from labor and to rest and to take in the wonders of God's world, to worship and seek peace and forgiveness, to express our love and respect and care for others. This is something that's emphasized, of course, among Christians, but it was also an emphasis among the Hebrews. Every seventh day, the Hebrews stopped work, gave thanks to the Lord. Every seventh year, debts were taken away from debtors, and there was a kind of renewal in the beginning. So the scripture emphasizes not only labor for God, it also emphasizes time to take a rest, to contemplate, and to think about what it is we are set here in the world to do. The question is, how can the principle of love and concern for our fellow beings be free of what we are now living in, one in which the market mentality seems to be central? Even Adam Smith, the influential 18th century economic philosopher whose book, The Wealth of Nations, developed the theme in which the greed of individuals becomes the driving force for the economic betterment of society as a whole, also wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments, in which he emphasized the importance of a shared moral, overcompassing love for fellow beings as a necessary feature of a viable society. We used to say, when we paraphrase Adam Smith, that out of everyone's vice, society becomes nice. The notion that, you know, a kind of selfish activity actually contributes to the betterment of society. And that's one side of what Adam Smith is writing about, but curiously enough, he also writes about, in the Moral Sentiments, he writes about the necessity of a moral order to preserve society. I raise these issues because it seems to me that the economic logic in which we are living is deeply embedded in our lives. And paradoxically, and especially during this Christmas season, it has obscured the significance of the gift of Christ in this teaching. And that when we emulate the giving of gifts, we have lost the idea of the difference between gift and a purchased item, in the sense that a gift is something that you give that is independent of the market, for example. I don't know. Kind of difficult to do that, but a gift is something in which you don't think about the value of it. You don't say, gee, I gave you a gift and it was worth more than what I've got here. The gift is really symbolic in terms of union with others, in terms of support of others. Giving gifts made possible by earnings from our labor is fine, but they should be given and received in the spirit of love rather than a secular transaction to advance our own interests. As we exchange gifts, we might consider that Christmas should be a time when we can reflect on the degree to which a kind of market mentality has eroded a mentality of love and concern for our neighbors, both near and far. And that reflection could also include a concern for the natural world as well. Christmas, it seems to me, should be a time of rest and reflection in which gift-giving expresses that reflective act. We might consider that our labor should be for others' benefit as well as ours, and the gift to another is an expression of that sentiment. Thank you.